Welcome to Unpacking Peanuts, the podcast where three cartoonists take an in-depth look at the greatest comic strip of all time, Peanuts by Charles M. Schulz.
Hey everybody, welcome back to the show. It's Unpacking Peanuts. We are going to begin 1980 today. I couldn't be more excited. Hope you're doing well. I'll be your host for the proceedings. My name's Jimmy Gownley. I'm also the cartoonist of Amelia Rules, Seven Good Reasons Not to Grow Up, and The Dumbest Idea Ever. Joining me, as always, are my pals, co-hosts, and fellow cartoonists. He's a playwright and a composer, both for the band Complicated People, as well as for this very podcast. He's the co-creator of the original Comic Book Price Guide, the original editor for Amelia Rules, and the creator of such great strips as Strange Attractors, A Gathering of Spells, and Tangled River. It's Michael Cohen.
Say hey.
And he's executive producer and writer of Mystery Science Theater 3000, a former vice president of Archie Comics, and the creator of the Instagram sensation Sweetest Beasts. It's Harold Buchholz.
Hello. How you doing?
I'm doing good. So we arrive here at the beginning of another decade. This will be our fourth decade of Peanut strips that we have read every single one of. And I just kind of wanted to talk to you guys a little bit at the beginning of this, kind of about the idea of decades. I find them strange and creepy in a way, in the sense that sometimes, you know, well, we always, it feels like, we define them with a few words, and we said that these 10 years were like this. And what's creepy about it is that it sometimes seems to work so well. And in Peanuts, it really works because it started in 1950 and it ends in 2000. So, you know, it's really easy to look at it decade by decade. But part of me, you know, knows that's false and wonders about that. I just wonder if you guys had any thoughts about that, you know, as we drift from the 70s into the 80s.
I don't think we can get too serious about decades. It seems to work better when there's a change of president on the decade year. The turn of the decade year, because, I mean, you can go 1980, definitely a shift. 2000, definitely a shift. Yeah, when we're talking about 1980, I think the 70s kind of leak into the 80s for a few years, which is fairly common. I mean, because we're always talking about the 60s, of course, and I sort of struggle with the thought of, is 1961 actually the 60s?
Right. There's definitely two versions of the 60s. You know, yeah. There's the Dick Van Dyke era, and then there's like the hippie era.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's sort of this twilight zone in between. So, yeah, getting into the 80s, I was keeping my eyes open for some kind of shift. And there are a few things, but I don't think it's he went like, oh, you know, new decade.
Right.
And change pens or something like that.
Right. Harold, what about you?
Yeah, I think it's fascinating that we try to make collective sense of things together and we kind of bounce it off of each other. And that's fascinating. What I find interesting is, as somebody who looked back into popular culture a lot from a pretty young age, I was interested in what happened in the past and especially things that aren't anymore, you know, that were of a time, and there's a portal into them, like, you know, old time radio. I mean, that just basically was a period that just had a sharp cut off point because TV came out. Silent film, another thing that's really interesting to me. And when I think about it, I go back and look on those decades, and I have these sharp delineations because people tried to define them, and I kind of bought into that. What's interesting to me, as I've lived the decades, especially as I grow into adulthood, what the 2010s were or the 1990s are becomes much foggier to me. I mean, the 80s is like the last period I can think of as a decade. I don't think, well, what were the 90s? I mean, I don't know. What were the aughts? I don't think of it that way because I lived it. And that overwhelms the
well, the 90s were the summit of Western civilization. I'm sorry, I forgot that.
Wow, are you serious?
The 90s? Oh my God, yeah. What you think it's better? Why? We don't have a podcast. Oh, that's a different podcast. Why? Because I was in my 20s, Harold. That's why.
Oh. You also got, you know, pre-1990s is pretty much pre-internet. So that's...
Well, once you get to the internet, boy, then it's a whole... It's a like, industrial revolution style shit.
Yeah, but I think in my case, it's like lived experience way out outweighs the collective consensus of a decade I didn't ever live in, right? So I think of it much more as this shifting continuity, because that was what your life is like, right? You don't have the experience on the New Year's Day, everything's shifted. But it was super helpful for me to think about the 20s and the 30s and the 40s and the 50s and the 60s as I was growing up, not really having experienced that, to be able to then go back and look at pieces of that culture and compare it against whatever that consensus was. And that's cool. I love that about decades, but I really, I don't know what people say about the aughts.
That's definitely past the time that we would have been at the center of the culture, you know, both in, I think, in our interest of what's going on, and also in the fact that that's when it started to be made for millennials as opposed to Gen Xers.
And yet that's the era when we start to actually have an impact, you know?
Right. Okay. Well, that's another thing. Like, no baby boomer culture was made by baby boomers, and no very few little Gen X culture was made by Gen X people. It's always those people who are either on the cusp or right, you know, at the tail end of the last generation, which then he gets into the whole idea of generations, which are even less useful than decades, because they even shift the dates of when they started constantly, you know?
but there is some kind of agreement that, okay, we're going to say this is when the generation begins and ends, and we're going to label it. I actually find a generational theory fascinating. I mean, especially the idea that there are four generations that just repeat each other.
Yeah.
And that, you know, there's a book called Generations written a long time ago, probably in the 80s or early 90s. And it's fascinating because it is predictive as well. So I remember reading that book a little after it came out, and they were describing where things were going to go in terms of how kids and parents got along. This was in a time when there was quite a bit of separation between kids and parents, and they're saying, well, they're going to get closer. And that seemed so alien to me, because that's not what I was seeing in the culture. And sure enough, you know, it did go that direction, where there were tighter bonds between parents and kids than, say, they were maybe when I was growing up, or say during the baby boom.
So, for example, they didn't have to make commercials reminding parents that they had children anymore.
Yes, right. Yeah. And, you know, and I remember, you know, seeing the baby on board sign showing up for the first time, and how that was such a strange thing, because the kids didn't want to be kids when I was growing up. You know, you couldn't get out of childhood fast enough. It seemed like there weren't G-rated movies, you know, even things that you would expect to be G-rated were like rated PG. Or you know, because that was just the way the culture was at the time.
Well, it's interesting. I you know, Schultz himself said that he didn't, when he said in some interview that when people talk about the 60s, the 70s, the 80s, he doesn't really know what they're talking about. He was just out there living his life. And that, you know, that's sense. Definitely also, someone who has the kind of job he has and who is a father, you know, you're not, especially
and,
when
and you're he's the one who's creating the culture. So.
Well, that's another thing too.
A little more down in the nitty gritty, instead of having the 30,000-foot view.
One thing I did notice this year is Snoopy. I mean, he looks markedly different than he did back in the Happy Dance days. It doesn't look like he can Happy Dance anymore. I think he's, being a dog, I think he's middle aged.
I see that.
I can see that as well.
He sleeps a lot. He lies on his doghouse. He plays around writing memoirs. He doesn't seem to do happy dances or run around and bump his head in croquet fields or whatever you call those things. No,
wicket. He lets Woodstock do that.
And he's also having regrets, right? He's saying things like, oh, I never bit somebody. Oh, I missed out on one of the great joys of life and all this sort of stuff.
Right.
That is interesting.
Yeah. And actually, one thing that did start the decade for Schultz is the National Cartoonist Society gave him the Elsie Seeger Award for Outstanding Contributions into the Field of Art, which is one of those kind of lifetime achievement things. So that's kind of where he is in his career. You know, when people are giving him retrospective awards, like, you know, it's not for what I'm doing now. It's for my lifetime.
One of the things I love to do is just put on YouTube in the background while I'm drawing or whatever, and it just plays a playlist of random stuff, and you never know what's going to come up. And I watched Paul McCartney receiving a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Grammys in 1990. He was like 48 years old, younger than me, and I'm like, no, this is awful. My God. Because it's almost like they're trying to play it off. Hey, congratulations. Now get out of the way.
Make room.
Well, and this is going to be a decade where there's going to be a lot of new blood coming into the comics page, really. I mean, you're going to have Calvin Hobbes and you're going to have the Far Side at the very least. You have things like on the weekly alternative comic side, things like Life in Hell.
Mm, yeah.
You know,
we were talking about competition for Schultz that had been influenced by Schultz. That's really starting to pick up around this time. People who read growing up Peanuts and they've incorporated his style and influence into their work. And now he's competing against himself.
Yes. He's competing really at himself and there, but a younger versions of himself who have learned everything that he taught as just by producing this strip.
Yeah. And that's an interesting place to be.
Yeah, well, it's such an advantage for people that come after him. Keith Richards always says, you know, I didn't know how to be in the Rolling Stones because there never was a band like the Rolling Stones before that just went on and on and on.
Right.
So there's no model for it. So you're going to screw up or you're not going to screw up. But whatever happens, other people are going to be able to see it and learn from it.
Right. That makes a lot of sense. Yeah. The other thing I noticed, there's a lot of legal and lawyer stuff this year.
Yeah.
And golf.
middle age stuff. Yeah. Yeah.
Like yeah. Yeah. I was like, oh no, what is Schultz going through right now with all this? There's contracts and there's for shoveling a walk and yeah, fascinating stuff.
Yeah. I wonder when his contract with United Features would have been up for renewal because it did change at some point.
Yeah. And I don't know with issues of divorce and all this stuff. I just don't know what he's having to deal with. And obviously he's overseeing this massive empire. Who knows what's coming up when someone's bugging him about this or that, you know?
Right. Do you think the day will come when it's public domain?
Yeah. Well, it has to.
Yeah.
Wow. That's going to be interesting.
Right. Well, I guess I mean, the big talk, of course, for those who've been following news and pop culture is that as of a day before we recorded this, Mickey Mouse and Steamboat Willie has gone into the public domain.
Somebody, and that's David Hahn, who's a very good comic artist, had a post today. He says, yeah, I'm working on my Mickey Mouse project where Steamboat Willie goes up river to take out Colonel Kurtz.
Kurtz.
Really interesting. And everyone's saying the irony, or not irony, but basically the idea that Walt Disney took all of these things that were in the public domain, like Snow White and these famous fairy tales, and he turned them into something new and fresh. And we had this interesting experience now that it's happening to Disney work. So it'll be interesting to see how it all plays out.
Well, okay, I'm going to throw a hypothetical at you guys. Okay, imagine Peanuts goes into the public domain tomorrow. Would you do anything with it?
No.
Yeah. I would.
Really?
I would take our Unpacking Peanuts things and I would reprint
the stuff. No. Oh, I would do that. Oh, sure. Absolutely. Wait, I revise my answer to that. I wouldn't make a peanut strip.
Would you attempt one? I mean, just for fun, like one?
No, I did one for fun. I'm got it. It's fine. Okay.
One and done.
One and done. I know where my level is for that. That's okay.
Yeah, that seems pretty daunting.
Would you, Michael?
No. Oh, God, no. But it would be interesting to single out one character and give him.
Maybe the bunny wannies. Maybe I would take it. Well, I'm dealing with public domain right now. I don't know how much I've said on the podcast, but I've got all of these public domain storybooks I've been collecting. I'm looking at shelves of them. And those of you who were on our live event where our backers joined us for a live event, which was lovely on December 30th, behind me were well over 100 public domain books that I picked up that were kids' storybooks that were like the mass market things, like, you know, little gold book type things. And that is something that I find fascinating. I love the public domain in the sense that you can engage with these prior works in ways that you can't with current works because of the copyright law.
Well, yeah. And I think, I mean, the public domain is a great idea that gives us resources to our own culture.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. And I think the internet has often softened a little bit of that. Things were so rigid and, you know, Disney was part of extending the copyright from 75 years to 95 years. Nothing went into the public domain for 20 years. And I think the culture kind of suffered for it. But I think that's why when the internet showed up, there was this massive push to be able to use other people's current works and, you know, a reaction video to someone's reaction of something that they were reacting to. You know, there's like these tiers of people experiencing other people's things, even if it's as something as unwrapping a product that somebody else made. We need that in the culture, and we had this dearth for 20 years, thanks to the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension Act that Disney was.
Is it really the Sonny Bono Copyright Extension
Act? I believe it is, yes. And you know, and Sonny was looking after his people. And but we had this period where we just didn't have the ability to take the culture. And what's really fascinating also is when I look back on culture in the 1900s, let's say, maybe when you hit the 20s, that's when things are starting to push their way into our culture in the sense of their relevance. You read a 1910 novel or look at a 1910 magazine, what are you going to pull from? But well, in the 20s, that's like the beginning of this modern era that we can somewhat relate to. We hit the 30s, that's going to ramp up. 40s, it's going to be taken off like crazy. Yeah. So I'm really going to be interested to see what happens. There's a lot of stuff is going to start to come into the public domain, and we're going to start to incorporate it into a new creative culture that is going to be reflexive and responding to what I guess is modern popular culture.
Yeah. Anybody can reissue silent movies and put in their own dialogue now.
Right. That's right. Yeah. Pretty much the entire canon of silent film is now public domain. So
Let's take a moment to appreciate copyright laws though.
Well, while you're alive.
Oh yeah, no, absolutely. It's great. It works both ways. It seems reasonable to me. You know, I'll own Amelia, and then my kids will own Amelia, and then good luck. Right? Like, you know, halfway through the next generation, that's
right. You know, yeah. I think we took it too far. I think 75 years was pretty good. They had a pretty good deal. It used to be 28 years. And then if somebody cared enough to renew it, you get it for another 47 years, and then it's done. That's 75 total. And then they got rid of the 20, and it was just 75, and then it was 95. So I think they went too far. I think the corporate culture had a little bit too much of an influence, and it hampers the discourse. So yeah, I'm not anti-copyright. I'm just anti too much copyright. And I think we went a little too far. I'm 95. We've gotten there. So, right.
That's let fine. Our grandchildren write their own comics. That's what I
think. Write make up your own things, kids. All right. Well, thank you for talking about that with me. I'm very, very interested in these sort of tangential things that come up just because we're looking at a work that has gone on for decades and decades. And it's such a rarity to be able to talk about something like that in depth. And then, since we're doing it, I love that we get to talk about all that ancillary cultural stuff around it. So thanks guys. And thank you all out there for listening. As I go through my cultural therapy once a week. Now, we're going to actually do though, for the rest of the shows, we're going to talk about the comic strips by Charles M. Schulz that he drew in 1980. So if you want to follow along with us, there's a couple things you can do. First thing you could do, you could go on over to our website, unpackingpeanuts.com. You can sign up for the Great Peanuts Reread, and then you'll get a newsletter once a month, and it'll tell you what strips we're going to be covering in the upcoming episodes. You can follow along if you decide to go out there and buy the Fantagraphics books. They're nice and bougie and look very good on your shelf. But if that's not your speed, you can go to gocomics.com, type in the dates we're talking about, and follow along there. For free, because that's the amazing part of the 21st century. So you guys do that and come on back here, and then away we'll go. January 6th. We start off with a classic symbolic panel, which is Peppermint Patty, but she looks a little bit like a dandelion. It's just her head atop, a plant. Then in panel 2, we see her looking at herself in the mirror in her bathroom. In the medicine cabinet. Then it's Peppermint Patty and Marcy walking to school. And Peppermint Patty says, "You know what I am, Marcy? I'm a weed." Peppermint Patty continues, "The world is filled with beautiful plants and flowers, but I'm just an ugly weed." They continue walking. It's now in silhouette. And Peppermint Patty says, "I'm a poor, ugly weed trying to push her way up through the sidewalk of life." Finally, Marcy responds, "That's a great metaphor, sir. Do you know that weeds have a wide tolerance for environmental conditions and the rare ability to exploit recently disturbed terrain?" Peppermint Patty says, what in the world does that mean? To which Marcy says, you can roll with the punches, sir. Peppermint Patty thinks about it and then says, by golly, Marcy, I think you're right. We're now in class with Peppermint Patty, and she says to the teacher, I've got my confidence back, ma'am. Ask me anything. Give me your best shot. And then in the last panel, we see her leaning up against the wall outside the principal's office as she says, I'll bet the principal would be surprised to find a weed growing in front of his office.
This is interesting, talking about decades, that this is how Schultz begins the Sundays for 1980s. I think it's a nice strip. It's he spent some time on this one. There's some really beautiful backgrounds in the list of things that are famously done inside of homes. I would also add the lovely fuzzy 1980s hand towel in the bathroom.
That's a good one. Very good one.
But got some stone walls and fir tree type things sticking out from there. There's a lot of interesting detail that gives the world a feeling of fullness in this strip.
Oh, I really like that first panel on the third tier there. I think that's a really nicely designed panel.
Yeah, and we always have talked about how Peppermint Patty's world seems a little rougher around the edges, and you get some of that feel here with these scrubs and things inside of the lawns, and yeah, it just has a slightly different feel than when he's drawing the world of Charlie Brown and Linus. And
absolutely.
But I just also like the conversation here, that, you know, this is a thoughtful strip, and I like the fact that you've got Marcy and Peppermint Patty getting into these kinds of conversations. It's just adding another level and layer to the strip with personalities we didn't have before.
Mm-hmm. You know, the other thing that's kind of interesting is that Marcy does not, I'm just thinking of this right now, but Marcy doesn't negate Peppermint Patty's thoughts and feelings.
Right.
She just says, okay, maybe, but here's the good side of that.
We haven't seen a lot of that, right? In the strip,
right.
It's usually competing ways of seeing the world that don't have this kind of merging and growing like a weed.
Well said. January 13th, Charlie Brown is carrying his good old snow shovel through the snow. He walks up to a house and rings the bell, ring. And then we see it is, in fact, Lucy's house. And he says, shovel your walk? Lucy says, sure, but you have to sign this contract. And she hands him a stack of papers, or she at least shows him a stack of papers. And the next panel, she's reading them and says, you will work for a flat fee, provide your own lunch, and pay your own insurance. If it snows within 24 hours, the sidewalk must be cleaned again without charge. We also have exclusive rights to your shovel. I'm sorry. We also have exclusive rights to your shovel. We reserve all TV, motion picture, radio, and video cassette rights in perpetuity. If you whistle while you work, all recordings become our property. The area to be shoveled runs from the porch to the street. Here, sign on the bottom line. She hands the contract to Charlie Brown, who looks at it, thinks for a moment, and then says, the contract is longer than the sidewalk.
This is great.
Well, if anyone's out there been a freelancer for Disney, you might understand some of that.
Yeah. Working at Archie and working on Mystery Science Theater 3000, I saw a lot of this stuff cross desks, and it changes the course of your job if you catch or don't catch these little clauses, because it changes everything. Ownership. It's crazy. But this is, to me, this is a mature strip of somebody who's living this now. And it's very funny and it's very insightful, but it's not, this wouldn't have come out in 1950 or 1960. That's for sure.
Right.
This is a new version. But it's still the kids dealing with adult ideas, right? It's just,
yeah, absolutely.
The boredom of legalese. And I just think it's very funny and very insightful. And I'm sure he's living it.
Oh, 100%. There's no question about that.
And I love his little mitten doorbell ring there. It's like he doesn't quite have it pulled up onto his fingers. It's got that little dip in that he's oversized. Maybe he got him for Christmas. He's going to grow into him.
January 19th, Snoopy's atop his doghouse and he's looking off panel at something and says, oh no, don't tell me. In the next panel, we see Woodstock has arrived holding something. In panel 3, Woodstock is playing away on what looks like some sort of little handheld game. And we just see much to Snoopy's consternation. Boop, beep, boop, 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 beep, 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 boop, 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 beep, boop, boop, whatever. And then Snoopy says, I hate it when he brings over his electronic games. I picked this one just because that's 1980 to me. Oh, I mean, I was eight. That is exact. Except it would have had to have a little doo 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 for shooting stormtroopers with Star Wars. But.
I like seeing Woodstock happy.
Oh. Yeah, yeah. There's such cute little pictures of Woodstock in the third and fourth panel. I also like the idea that Woodstock can fly without using his wings because he's holding on to his electronic games. It looks like someone just threw him in from off stage in panel two.
I like that. He just got tossed in. Oh my gosh.
What was out in 80? When did Asteroid come along?
Yeah. Okay. So 79, I think I got the Atari 2600, and that had like, it came with Space Invaders, but I also got like Asteroids and Combat. But like the little handheld electronic games were things like, there was like a football game, which I loved. There was head to head baseball, which I loved. There was a basketball one, which I could not comprehend. There was a thing called Merlin, which was like it looked like a big red phone, and you played like tic tac toe and really lame. I had that.
Yeah, for those youngsters, when we say a Milton Bradley, say football game handheld, it looks like a stadium, like with all of the seating around this rectangular screen, and
which
there are
red dots.
three lines of like LED that go across maybe, I don't know, eight wide,
maybe,
and I mean literally lines, and you're supposed to hit the buttons to go up and down to get across these blockers.
Which is just other lines. You can't touch them.
That takes a tremendous amount of imagination to think of it as football, but I had it probably around this time. And I didn't have any of like the plug in your TV ones. I just had the Milton Bradley football game like Woodstock has here that you could carry around and change out that 9-volt battery every once in a while.
Yeah, it's like they invented the game and then said, well, what is this? And then, can we call it football? Yeah, sure. We'll brand it football and then say football. I knew one kid who actually learned how to pass on it, which was next to impossible. Yeah.
I see it. Really? You could pass on it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. But you had to be hardcore. Shout out to Jim Dwyer if you're out there.
I missed out on an entire level of the world's simplest game.
No, you have to. No, you have to really dedicate your life to learn how to pass.
That shows why you should read the instructions, boys and girls. You lose out. You think there's nothing to this. But man, that was a game changer, right? All of a sudden, there's these electronic things that you're playing against. It's just now starting, and it's gonna change our lives. As Michael said in the previous episode, you know, video games are bigger than going to movies now. It's a much bigger business.
Michael, when did you start writing computer games?
It was around this time, probably around 82. Yeah, I just wanted to write adventure games, like text adventure games, which at this time were very popular, but there was no graphics whatsoever. So I spent years.
So describe a text adventure game to those who haven't experienced these.
Yeah, I remember the first time I saw one, my friend Mark just bought a Mac and they just come out. And he said, look at this. And there's like a sentence on just a text saying like, you are on a beach. And then now he says like, type go left. So I type go left and it says like, you were on the left side of a beach. And I went like, oh my God, this is mind-boggling.
That's cool. So did you get other people to play the games you were writing?
I worked on it years. I went back to school. I actually got a degree in programming. And by the time I was done with school, graphics had come in and everything I had learned was totally useless.
Right up to like the Mac, it was 80 to 84, something like that. Or that would have been when you were in, or?
Yeah, I graduated around there, around 85 or 6. But I remember working on this one game and I'd hit the max. I did everything, you know, switching drives, and it finally went like, it cannot take any more information. So my file was so huge. It was 1 meg.
Wow.
Wow.
And I sort of finished it, but I couldn't actually finish it because it was a whole meg and there's no way.
Wow.
It was a great game.
That's crazy. So you didn't cut down your...
You have to start like, yeah, you have to throw this out.
Use synonyms that are shorter.
Yeah, I was trying to do a thing
where... Shorter way to say beach.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, I was having a thing where you could have a box in your pack. And you can look in your pack and there's a box. And you take out the box, you can open the box. There's another box in the box. And so I had basically a city, you know, with no graphics, just describing the city and some of the rooms you could go into.
And the underground city, too.
Yeah. Anyway, I loved it. I absolutely loved the fact that I was creating this world. But I think like two people ever played it.
I played it a little bit.
You did?
I played it.
Yep. You had it on an old, boy, I don't even know what it computer it was up in New PC. Hampshire.
Yeah. There's a couple of people played it and that's it. I didn't remember you
doing it. Yeah. Yeah. Because you weren't even sure if it was going to run.
Uh-huh.
But it did.
So what year would this have been when you were playing it?
Well, that was...
When I played...
Yeah.
Well, we met in the 90s. So, stashed it in the closet. The computer was gathering dust because I didn't want to throw out the old computer because that was the only place the game existed in the world.
Wow.
I remember that day because crazy. The other thing about it was Michael showed me his comic book collection, which is... stunning comic book collection. And I'm like, oh, I never saw this Duranko Captain America. He's like, oh, here, he hands me one. Immediately, the tape from the back of the bag sticks to the cover. I'm like, no.
No.
I got it off. But, oh, my God, the stress. Those text-only games had a comeback a few years ago as apps on the app. Store on Apple. I played one called In a Dark Room. It was really good, really interesting. Yeah,
well, there is a genre of, I think mostly Japanese, of stories, interactive stories, where you know you make decisions, and they're like very popular, like romance comics. You're mm-hmm. trying to get the girl, really? And they give you choices on what to say. Yeah, I mean, I haven't looked into it, but graphics, I never understood graphics, and I'm glad I stopped when I did, because I decided after years of, you know, devoting my entire life to this programming, I decided maybe I should do something different. Maybe I'll try to publish a comic.
Always a good idea. If I have any word of advice for you people out there, when in doubt, publish a comic. It makes everything better. January 31st. This is the middle of a sequence where Peppermint Patty is getting rained and snowed upon in school because there's a leak in the ceiling. And as she is called the world famous attorney, which, by the way, I never looked how stern Snoopy looks in panel one. That's very funny. So she has called her attorney in to talk to the principal. And she says to him, "Yes, sir, Mr. Principal, we demand satisfaction." She's dripping wet. In panel two, she says, "I'm tired of sitting in a classroom under a leaking ceiling. My attorney and I have come to lodge an official protest." And in the last panel, we see Snoopy giving the side eye, and he says, "If he calls me a pettifogger, I'm leaving."
Is this an obscurity? Is that why that's here?
Peanut obscurities explain.
This is an obscurity. And also, it represents, once again, after the contract with the shoveling, we're just a...
Right.
You know, a few weeks into the new year, and we've got more lawyering going on. So, yeah. So, I didn't know. Had you guys ever heard of this term before?
Never.
No. I think I've heard it, but yeah. I didn't know what it was. I know it was an old thing from like 1900.
It dates back like, I don't know, 400.
Oh, really?
Years.
Okay.
Or, yeah. And it's basically what you'd expect. It's a lawyer. One definition is you're petty, underhanded, or disreputable, kind of a shark or a shyster. Or doing trifling things, small things. So, yeah, I it's a funny word, and Schultz was always good at finding funny words. So, yeah. Too bad it wasn't in quotes, though.
Yeah, then it would have made it even better.
Yeah,
yeah. To me, it sounds like something you would use to get rid of. It's like a pesticide. You know, those old a pettifogger.
Quick, Henry the Flit.
I didn't like this sequence because I think there were actually laws of absurdity. Certain kinds of absurdity are okay. But what he's doing is he's doing what we call a compound absurdity, where the rain falling on one student, drenching one student, leaking from the ceiling is absurd because no one ever does anything about it. And then compounding it with her hauling in the lawyer is like, okay, this is too much. It's like there are different kinds of infinity. Did you know that? Some infinities are bigger than others.
Everyone who's read A Fault in Our Stars, I think, that has T-shirts that say some infinities are bigger than others.
Yeah, and so some absurdities are absurd. Some other absurdities, you can kind of, Superman, okay, he's flying, sure. But I would say this is what I would call a second level absurdity.
I think I would agree with you, Michael. I kind of enjoy when stuff like this can go to basically an absurdity built on an absurdity built on an absurdity. It's taking you out on a limb, and I kind of enjoy that. I think we've mentioned it before. Even something as simple as like a Three Stooges comedy, where they're playing off of something they had done 10 years earlier, which is played off of something that was done before that. And we've seen it all. And so it's so removed from reality that starts to become funny to me.
Yeah.
That you're so far away and yet you can kind of see how you got there.
Yep.
But it's like, wow, we got that far away from reality because somebody did a fantasy on a fantasy on a fantasy.
Well, this is an interesting topic because, I mean, a lot of times in comic strips, the setup for the joke, somebody says something, is absurd. No one would ever say that.
Right.
Which kind of, to me, kind of kills the joke. Because,
yeah, it's like when someone walks up to you and goes, do you want to hear a joke? Not really. Like, if you want to be funny, be funny, but don't tell me it's a joke and now I have to sit here and wait for it. Yeah, I know exactly what you mean. It's just an artificial situation.
When we used to talk about one of the classic comic strip tropes, but who knows who started it, is in the last panel somebody says something and the other person, you just see their feet as they're flying backward. But you know, to me it would be very funny if somebody just took all of those and then just kept building onto it, like, so the guy falls back and then he hits his head and then he loses his amnesia and you just go out on the limb 100 times and see how far you can take it, the absurdity of it.
Speaking of absurdity, this might be a new feature, but or it also might not be. I got Michael, after years of prodding, to dip into Infinite Jest, my favorite book. And he's listening to the podcast, Infinite Cast. Michael, just quick update. How are you enjoying it so far? Speaking of absurdities.
Chapter 37.
Chapter 37.
Well, no. So, excuse me. Podcast 37. Generally, they don't always get. So anyway, we're talking around 20 hours into the reading of the book.
And you enjoying it so far?
There's some chapters that are really hard for me. Yeah. And there's two things. I mean, the book is based on two things, both of which I have zero interest in.
Tennis and addiction.
Tennis and drug addiction. So considering that, I'm enjoying it a lot.
All right. So you guys tune in for some later episode where we check in on Michael's progress on Infinite Jest. Okay.
Better than one word a day, you know, War and Peace way.
How great was it having Mrs. Schultz in and having her tell us that story about him leaving a voice message for Lee Mendelssohn? It's just one of the greatest things we've ever had.
So if you haven't listened to that one, go back and find our interview with Jeannie Schultz.
It's a banger. She's a delight. February 9th. Woodstock and Snoopy are atop the doghouse. Woodstock is straining and making his eyes huge. And Snoopy says, yes, I think you'd make a great owl. And then the next panel, though, Woodstock looks all discombobulated with stars of pain shooting out from his head. And Snoopy, with concern, says, but that hurt, didn't it? I should have warned you. When you open your eyes that wide, you let too much light inside your head.
The big joke's in the first panel.
Yeah, right?
And this goes to what you're saying about Snoopy, right, Michael? Because it's like Woodstock is now kind of the little child and Snoopy's kind of the parent or the big brother or whatever you want to call it. And so he feels a little more middle-aged. He's not doing it. He's coaching Woodstock.
Yeah.
It's Snoopy Watch.
We'll see a lot of this Snoopy, and I think this is distinctively different than the earlier Snoopy, the mini Snoopies, but sitting in this position very much like a stuffed animal and not moving.
Doesn't move. I actually did not notice that. Yeah, just the tail.
Right. Where do you think the nose is, how the nose is placed, Michael?
It seems a little low to me.
It doesn't it? Yeah. No, I don't know how long he's been doing that. It just jumped out at me when you were talking about the look of Snoopy. And I was like, he doesn't drop his head to look at Woodstock. He just drops the nose, which is fascinating. The nose is kind of even, and the nose is not even pointing directly at Woodstock's eyes. It's actually pointing at maybe his little tail feather.
You know, it's possible we're looking at these things too closely.
What?
Is it a little too late to bring that up? Is that too?
How many hours later? Oh, man, we could be doing these in like 10 minutes a show.
Now, you see here, he has a piece of fuzz attached to his
pendant. Whoa, wait a minute. What is a weird little thing in Woodstock's head above in the last panel? It's like a snowflake and a little cloud.
I've never seen that before. That's an original.
Yeah. Is that supposed to be the pain dissipating?
Maybe.
Like that, like the dots are like a star that's fading out or something?
I don't know.
It does look like the star is starting to, dissipate like a little cloud. Because he draws... Now, what do you guys think about the rounded stars? That was something he also did that was not typical of comics. The pointed star of pain was typical. Here he's got rounded 5-point stars.
I can't even see that close.
I prefer pointed stars, I think.
Me too. Yeah. But it does feel very dating game.
Oh, it's absolutely those vinyl flowers that you would get and like put in your shower walls and stuff like that.
Maybe that's what he was seeing every morning when he woke up and took a shower.
That's a good one. Oh, now coming up here, we have a long sequence with Peppermint Patty, who wants to be taken on a date to her school Valentine's Day dance. And she has Charlie Brown set her up with some groovy guy. and she made it clear she did not want it to be his weird dog, Snoopy, or Snoopy was disappointed about because he loves disco. So we pick it up here on February 13th with Peppermint Patty sitting on the front steps of her house in a little black sleeveless dress, looking just as cute as can be. She says, "I think I'll sit here on the front steps and wait for my date. A boy likes to know a girl is interested enough to be ready when he calls," says Peppermint Patty. Where she got this advice, no one knows. Then panel three, she's rolling her eyes up with a sense of playfulness and says, "I wonder who it's going to be. I hope he's a good dancer. It'll also help if he's a real sharp dresser." And in panel four, we see who Charlie Brown set her up with, and it's Pigpen, who shows up saying, "Hi, my name is Pigpen," to which Peppermint Patty says, "Ugh!"
This was a real shock.
Yeah.
I was stunned. I mean, I thought Pigpen was gone for good, but wow.
Oh, yeah, right? I'm not sure if it's this one, but it's one of the ones in this sequence that I was looking on the Peanuts wiki, that it's an anniversary appearance of Pigpen. How many times do you think Pigpen has appeared from 1950 to this sequence total?
How many times?
Wow.
Got to be a couple of hundred.
36?
You say, well, Harold says 36, and Michael says, narrow it from a couple hundred.
Oh, I'll say 200.
100. Mm-hmm. Only 100.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
Yeah, with that huge 9-year gap. So, but he makes a big comeback. And I think this is a real smart way to reintroduce him to the gang. And I think he fits in real well with Peppermint Patty because they're iconoclasts, which I love.
Yeah, he's and he loves disco, so this was this time to come back, right?
Absolutely.
Snoopy and Pigpen and Peppermint Patty disco dancing.
Which we see on Valentine's Day itself, February 14th. Peppermint Patty and Pigpen are dancing. Pigpen is doing the classic John Travolta point at the sky look. And Peppermint Patty says, "This is some weird date that Chuck got for me." They continue dancing in panel two. Peppermint Patty thinks to herself, "I must admit, he can dance, though." Then in panel three, she starts to strike up a little conversation What's your sign, Pigpen? Do you come here often? And the last panel, she's lost him in a cloud of dust and just says, where did he go? I picked this one. I had this book when I was a kid. And what's your sign, Pigpen? Do you come here often? I don't know why. Always made me laugh out loud. It also has something to do with the weird dance Pepper and Patty's doing, which kind of looks a little bit like the twins dance from the Christmas special.
And Pigpen might be wearing the white suit from Saturday Night Fever as well. We just don't know.
He's definitely wearing a blazer.
Yeah.
Which is real nice. I think it's great that Pigpen.
Now, is this before Labor Day or after Labor Day on February 14th?
You know, that's like that movie Gremlins, Don't Feed Them After Midnight. Isn't every moment of the day after midnight?
Somewhere.
Right? Isn't that like the worst possible advice?
That's problematic.
So I don't know. He can wear white anytime. Well, it won't be white long with Pigpen anyway. Oh, and then after the dance, February 16th, we see Marcy with no glasses on answering the phone at 3 a.m. She says, hello, who's calling? It's 3:00 a.m. Of course, it's Peppermint Patty calling, who says, hi, Marcy, it's me. I know it's 3:00 a.m, but I can't sleep. You know why I can't sleep? And then in panel 4, we see a ridiculously beaming Peppermint Patty saying, I'm in love. Marcy basically falls asleep on the floor with the phone on top of her head and says, I'm sure you'll be very happy, sir. Now, the double cartooning joke here is that the punctuation in Peppermint Patty's I'm in love panel is hearts, and the punctuation in Marcy's panel is Z's, indicating sleep.
That's cute. I want to concentrate on panel 3.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Death is not a Schultz face. Is he giving tribute to another cartoonist?
No, I think he's just trying to do it. Do you have one in mind?
Well, it looks like one of the mad artists did that kind of smile with the teeth like that, and I can't remember who it would be. Drucker or somebody?
Mort Drucker?
No, well, I don't know. But that's just, I mean, Schultz has never done a smile like that. Or is there another strip that, you know, like Kathy or something that looks more like that?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think of Kleiban, who's the cat guy before Garfield in the 70s. But I don't know. It does have that kind of grunge. We were talking about the 70s look. I mean, Peppermint Patty is all 70s. And this is, he probably drew this right before the clock ticked over. The after midnight.
Well, it's a double whammy. What's making it look atypical is he's got the whites around the eyes, which is weird. And when he does the smile with the teeth, which he will do, but it's a giant smile with the teeth. This, because it's the mouth is not open as wide, it makes them look like very small teeth, which is odd.
And it's messy, right? You got the shaky line and the teeth that seem to be kind of not straight. And yeah, it's a little creepy.
Now, speaking of the shaky line, are you guys? I don't see a big change between last year and this year.
No, I didn't. I never noticed it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I've been noticing it. It hasn't gotten. It's funny. It's mostly I see it on the bottom of the word balloons.
Oh yes.
The thing that struck me this year, and I was noticing it before, and I was not enjoying the line thickness in the dailies, because it seemed like everything was thicker, but it was less varied than the past. But now I'm looking at what you guys pulled out. I'm reading it from the Fantagraphics books, and they pull out the copyright notice, so you don't have to, you know, so you don't have to look at it. That's been taken out. This is not really part of the art. Here on the Go Comics, you see the copyright notice, and it's ridiculous how thickened the line is, because you can actually see the font of copyright 1980 United Features Syndicate Inc. And it is so thickly blurred that would suggest that Schultz actually was working much thinner, but for whatever reason, the photostat machine that they were using either on Schultz's side or a United Feature, which is probably United Feature, is thickening the lines.
Yeah.
And I don't know if that was a choice they were making because the strips were getting smaller and other people weren't adjusting the way Schultz was. And so you get this muddy looking artwork, which, you know, for people who've seen the originals, maybe we've lost a lot of the detail because everything's just kind of getting thicker because they underexposed the camera or whatever. But the Sundays look way different. The Sundays, I have the crispness that I'm used to, which is interesting, but I guess he's working larger compared to smaller, maybe in a different ratio than he did in the past.
You know, Dave Sim did a book called The Strange Death of Alex Raymond, which is about, it's about a lot of different things, but it's primarily organized around the idea of the photorealist newspaper strips from the 40s to the 80s, I guess. And one of the things he talks about is how reliant the artist was on whoever it was, the engraver, or who was, you know, taking that original art and making it into something that could be reproduced in the newspaper. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to be fair to the people who are trying to do that, it's like one of those things, like if you go too thin, you'll have the nice thicks and thins, but the real thins will disappear. And if you expose it too much, then those thins will appear, but everything else will thicken up. It's everything was much more difficult.
Right.
He talks about something I've never heard before. Is it called angel strokes? Angel something?
Nightingale strokes.
Nightingale strokes. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's like these guys could do these lines. And essentially, it would be one hair of the brush.
Yeah.
I mean, masters of control. But they were, wow. I think they were sort of like competing with each other to see who can get like the most delicate lines possible.
Yeah.
Here's another theory. 1980, it's possible that Schultz got like a photocopier,
yeah,
in his office. And so instead of sending the originals in and possibly losing them or causing trouble, or maybe United Features like, hey, if you send them in, we won't charge you. I don't know. But it's possible he was using a 1980 photocopier, and to get the blacks black, he had to crank it up. And so this is actually what he's sending to them with an inferior technology that might be harming the quality, because it just seems odd to me.
Yeah. It's amazing that any of it ever, in the 80s, if you start looking at some of the Marvel comics that were printed in the 80s or DC comics, when they switched to
flexographic.
Oh, boy.
Oh, awful. Yeah. It's like the printing people, I don't know if it was cheaper. They just said, hey, we're switching over to this stuff. I think those like the plates they used to like print cardboard boxes, like you know like craft boxes, like, you know, you got the Amazon box back in the day. It was a really inferior process, but it was cheaper. And the other thing was the blacks couldn't print solid, so you get these weird things where you have this grayish black and you can see the colors underneath where somebody had cut the, you know, the litho for the color, and the blue is, you can see the blue plate under the black. It's not a good time period for comics.
Now, the blue plate under the black is awful. Cartoonist Tom Scioli calls that skin cancer black.
Oh.
See all the disgusting and anyway. Well, with that thought, we're going to take a break. So you guys just hang out right here for a second. We're going to go get a snack, and then we'll come back on the other side and pick up with the strips.
Hi, everyone. I just want to take a moment to remind you that all three hosts are cartoonists themselves, and their work is available for sale. You can find links to purchase books by Jimmy, Harold, and Michael on our website. You can also support the show on Patreon or buy us a mud pie. Check out the store link on unpackingpeanuts.com.
And we're back. Hey, Liz, I'm just hanging out here in the mailbox. Do we got any letters?
We do. Don Kelly wrote to us and says, listening to Charles Schultz speaking at UCLA in 1971 on YouTube, someone asks why Violet, Patty, and Shermie don't show up too often. Schultz replies, because they are straight men and only get used when a straight man is needed for particular lines.
Boy, I wouldn't say they were straight men. Or straight women.
Yes. Well, okay. See, I'm interested in that because, right. So here, here is Schultz saying this. This is what he said. When was he speaking? 1970, you said?
71.
Okay. So he's like, they are straight men. Now, having read every one of these strips, they're not for a long time. And then eventually they sort of become that. Or am I projecting that?
No, the straight man. No, they're instigating. And they're making the jokes.
Very often they're making the joke.
Yeah, they're creating the situation and commenting on it. And often Charlie Brown just is standing there listening to them.
Michael, why do you think Schultz said that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know why he cut those characters out either. Except all his female characters were kind of mean. Maybe he thought that was not a good look.
I mean, I could see if he said there, I wouldn't say this if I were the creator, but I would say there may be more two-dimensional. But straight man sounds a little more planned.
Yeah. I don't think there's ever been a straight man character in Peanuts that stuck around for any length of time.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was Shermie's job, pretty much. And Franklin also, who hasn't really appeared much in the last decade, was pretty much a straight man. I think Schultz gave him one or two punchlines, but that's about it.
Yeah, and I mean, to me, a straight man is the one who sets somebody else up for the joke, but maybe Schultz meant they're not inherently funny in themselves.
But they're hilarious.
I don't know. But I think in Franklin, I mean, Franklin seems to me to be a little more philosophical in some of them. And he's definitely a character, and you sense there's a depth and dignity to him. But because of that, I think it's harder to give him a joke that is his, right?
Mm-hmm.
He might say something that's a little more profound or insightful, but it's not necessarily the punchline. Or if it is, it's going to be a soft punchline.
Right. And I do think that in upcoming years, that side of characters like Franklin becomes more prominent as Schultz figures that out, like how to do that. And it's basically by doing a lot of stuff with Franklin and Charlie Brown at the Wall.
Yeah, but I think the big point is that the creator is not always the best critic of his own work.
Oh, 100%. That's true. A lot of times the worst to be able to see what's going on, you know? Well, I can think of elements like that in my own work where people have said things about it. And I go, oh, that's great. I wish I would have thought of that at the time.
I'm a genius.
I'm brilliant. I didn't understand any of that, but great. So if you want to get in touch with us, you can email us through unpackingpeanuts@gmail.com, or you could follow us on social media. We're on Blue Sky and Instagram. We're @unpackpeanuts. And on Facebook, we're Unpacking Peanuts. And you can follow us on YouTube. Well, we had some excitement coming up here. Good old YouTube really did us a favor. And we got a lot of new viewers for our Christmas episode re-release, which was great. And the other thing we did over the holiday break, we ran our very first special live event for our Patreon subscribers. And it was a blast. So, guys, you want to just talk about that a little bit? Because we're going to be doing them more frequently coming up, and we would love to have as many of you participate as possible. We had a real great crowd the first time.
Yeah, I was really happy with it. And we ended up interviewing them.
And right.
Interesting bunch of people, creative bunch of people.
I'm fascinated to see, and we just scratched the surface of it, of how you as listeners are interacting with the podcast. You know, are you driving? Are you working? Are you just listening? There's a really interesting different ways you can interact with this. You can read the strips in advance. Maybe you're just listening to the podcast, and then do you ever go back because we mentioned something, or are you just listening and it's in your theater of the mind? I'm guessing there's a lot of different ways people are interacting with it, but it's helpful to me to know, you know, from the people who listen, how do you engage with us? Is there anything in here that is particularly enjoyable, or is there something like, oh no, they're doing that again?
Now, I will warn you though, if you say, oh no, they're doing that again, I will just do it more.
Well, that's true. So be careful about how you give us feedback to Jimmy. He's doubling down.
I wasn't feeling well over Christmas. I had terrible stomach pain. And I went to the doctor and they said, oh yeah, I don't know. Maybe you just eat crackers for a couple of days. I'm like, okay, thanks a lot. So I came home, ate a ham sandwich, drank Coke. Next day felt much better. And my daughter said to me, so you went to the doctor? I said, yes. Then you didn't do what they said? Yes. And then you felt better? I said, yes. She goes, so you just needed an authority figure to defy, and you appeared. I'm like, yes, very insightful, you get daughter. Me, Anna. You get me. But I had a blast doing it. I was probably the least into the idea of doing it, but I had maybe the most fun, which is, you know, as is my wont in life, to be dragged kicking and screaming, but then have fun.
I loved the fact that it was a wide cross section. I mean, we had people who are probably barely 20 and people who are older than Michael.
What?
Can you imagine?
Mathematically? No. But I'm kidding.
Yeah. Yeah. Really, really different insights and people coming at it from all different angles. And we're all coalescing here in Unpacking Peanuts, which I think is amazing and wonderful because we're enjoying diving in here. And the fact that we're not alone and there are people as engaged as we are is just boggling my mind.
Yeah, we're all living in happy piggy land.
That's one of my favorite things to do for the podcast is name the episodes. It's always fun. All right, guys, what do you say? First off, let me just say, so if you guys want to be a part of the next one, you could just kick in a little something on Patreon, right? Is that what it is, Liz?
Yeah, you can go to patreon.com/unpackingpeanuts and take it from there.
Awesome. We would love to see you at the next one. All right, let's get back to the strips. February 22nd, Linus, Lucy, and Charlie Brown are all at the thinking wall. Charlie Brown, however, is walking away, and Linus and Lucy are just sitting there sort of staring out into space. In panel two, Charlie Brown is left, and Linus and Lucy are looking out after him. And Linus says, "One thing I have to admit about Charlie Brown, he is absolutely without guile." And then in panel four, Lucy turns and looks off in Charlie Brown's direction again and says, "I knew he was missing something." That's a throwback. Kind of, that's a classic.
Yeah, I was just going to say that. It's just, it looks and feels very, very classic. Could fit in the 60s without anyone noticing anything.
Yeah, for sure.
I think I'd mentioned a few years back that I was noticing that the characters as a rule didn't lie to each other the way I'd seen other, you know, pop cultures, like some things are based in lies, like watching old Bewitched episodes and I Dream of Jeannie, where the whole thing is you're trying to keep alive from somebody or Mr. Ed. That was just a thing. And this strip is kind of devoid of that for the most part. I think the one example that I said certainly disproves that to some extent is Lucy with the football. But I have a theory that Schultz was not terribly aware of that part of Charlie Brown until he'd made the January 4th strip where Lucy is saying, "Charlie Brown, do you think I wasn't invited to a New Year's party because I'm too crabby?" And Charlie Brown's response is, "No, you were probably invited to 9 parties, but all the invitations were lost in the mail." And then Lucy walks away kind of satisfied with that answer. And I remember when I read it, I was jarred because it looked like Charlie Brown was basically
zinging her,
lying to her. Yeah. Or lying to her. Yeah. And so I was struck by that because it's like, that doesn't feel like Charlie Brown. Well, this strip here comes out maybe 7 weeks later. So it would have had maybe two to three weeks for people to write in when this thing actually came out. That's my theory, is that people wrote in and said, "That's not like Charlie Brown." And then he said he's guileless. And then Schultz thought about it and did this strip. So that's entirely conjecture. When I read it, I was like, "Oh, good. I'm glad he's clearing up something that was a misstep on January 4th.
But can you prove your theory in a court of law?
Well, maybe somebody, a pettifogger, might be able to. But I don't know if there's anybody at the Schultz Museum who has access to, I don't know, did they keep mail like that? I guess they did. But anyway, I don't know if anybody on the inside would have any insight into that if I'm completely off my rocker, or maybe there's a little hint somewhere that that is the case.
Well, whether or not you're completely off your rocker is independent of whether or not Schultz.
Well, that's Charlie Brown. That's true. Yeah. I don't even have a rocker anymore. It's in storage. So
February 25th, Lucy is hanging out at Schroeder's piano in her classic position as Schroeder is practicing away. And Lucy says, "I think I'd like to take piano lessons." Then she turns to Schroeder and says, "Wouldn't you like to give me piano lessons?" Schroeder, without looking up, says, "No." Then in the next one, Lucy sits next to him, says, "We could sit side by side." And Schroeder says, "I think I'll switch to the violin." So weird seeing Lucy sit behind the
piano.
Yeah, it looks so wrong.
Isn't it weird?
Yeah, I think Schroeder would agree with you, Michael. Yeah, that is true. You could take an eye out with a violin. That's someone that close to being next to you.
Harold, I'm not looking at this in the Fantagraphics book, although I have them and love them. I'm looking at this on Go Comics, but panel four, I'm really seeing what I think you're talking about with the thickness of the lines. Actually, and panel three too, like looking at Lucy's face. Yeah.
It's even varied here. And again, this kind of goes back to Schultz living with the fact that he has less control than he used to have because of the shake of the hand. He's got a lot of things to take into account when he's putting ink on paper. And I think he's working faster a lot of times. You see little blips and things that you didn't in the past where, you know, the ink dip is a little too heavy for the lettering and this and that. And it's just part of the strip now. And it's something that he's moving through and he's not letting it stop him.
I'm a fan. I want to see his hand in the work. I love that. I mean, I cannot take auto-tune. Like listening to modern pop music that is just tuned within an inch of its life.
Mm-hmm. Especially if they have the dial that's going between the notes while you're just holding it.
So bad. I was listening to a podcast and they were talking about, they were talking about the Beach Boys, I think. And someone was playing Beach Boys to like their younger nephew or niece. And they're like, they're out of tune. Like the Beach Boys are out of tune.
Well, live, they certainly were.
Yeah, no, but they're just talking about the recordings and the albums. And what they mean by it is it's not auto-tuned. It doesn't sound like what they sound, what they've exclusively heard for music. It's this constant elimination of the person, which I find very troubling. Which doesn't have to come from technology. By the way, because I was thinking about this, you know who's a brilliant artist who, as far as I know, only does digital? Well, no, doesn't. But they're commercial, the stuff they're known for is all digital. Steve Conley is middle age. That could only be done by Steve Conley, and it's completely digital. It's not like the tool is the problem. You know,
right? It's what, because you can put settings on those tools. Like you were saying, you can, for those of you who don't use these art tools, there are literally settings you can make. If you're trying to do an arc and your hand is a little wavery, you can say, well, I want that to smooth by, it's a 2 out of 10 or a 10 out of 10, and you'll get a perfect arc at 10. And yeah, it's a choice you can now make that's not your actual hand. It's the computer. Now, it's still a choice, right? It's an artistic choice, It is taking information away from how you actually engaged with the program.
Now, I love the line quality in Tangled River. It has like a clear line style that I can still see. I can 100% see your hand in it. How much did you fool around, Michael, with adjusting line, those controls Harold's talking about? Or did you just look at it like almost like this is paper, but digital paper?
Yeah, no, I never use those. Matter of fact, I'm not even aware that they exist.
That's the difference. That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, I'd like to have a tight line, but I wasn't going to use tricks.
Right.
I get it.
What program were you using to draw Tangled River, Michael?
I was doing Pixelmator on most of those.
Pixelmator? I've never
used it. It's like a Photoshop for Mac.
Okay.
Yeah, I do like to get a very precise line, but in a way, I probably overuse the line tool for backgrounds and things.
Line tool is essentially where you're creating just a straight line.
Yeah, you're just pulling the line out and positioning where you want it. Yeah, where that might affect the look of the strip.
Yeah, it works in a science fiction setting though perfectly.
Right, yeah.
That's another thing.
Yeah, and intentionality is a huge part of, how people engage with art is, does it say I meant to do that?
Right.
Or, as my wife, Diane Cook's teacher said when she was studying art, it was like, is it the truth? Is another way they put it. And you look at other people's art. That's what you're asking, whether it's successful. Is it the truth?
Yeah.
Right.
That's why I will accept an abstract artist. I'd take him a lot more seriously if I could see some early work where, he can actually paint a vase with flowers.
Right.
And he chooses not to, but rather than go like, well, this guy, who knows if he can draw?
Yeah, it's always interesting when you see something like this. Someone who has this explosive way of working that just changes everything, but that also on the surface is fairly easy to copy. I think like Picasso's, some of his later stuff, like he's just going through all these different styles and periods and stuff like that. But then he leaves it all behind in his wake, and a lot of people are able to go, oh, I can do that. And then you sort of kill painting, because like is painting even a what is painting in the 21st century?
Mondrian and Jackson Pollock make things a little problematic.
Yeah, yeah, Pollock is a better example even. Yeah,
yeah, but can Jackson Pollock actually draw like Probably Captain America? Not. I don't know.
No, that's what I'm saying. I don't think so. I doubt it. Right?
Not yeah. anymore.
I mean, Jack Kirby could probably do a Pollock easier than Jackson Pollock could do a Kirby.
Well, the great critique of all of this is the Norman Rockwell painting of the guy looking at the Jackson Pollock painting.
Yeah, right.
Is brilliant. All right. Anyway, March 23rd, Snoopy is standing out in what looks like a little parking lot, and he says, "Why do they do that?" And he walks on what looks like I don't even know what, and he says, "I just don't understand." Then Snoopy walks over to his doghouse, and he finds Woodstock, his old pal Woodstock, waiting for him atop it. And Snoopy says to Woodstock, "You're a bird. Maybe you can tell me. I just saw a bunch of quail over in a parking lot." Snoopy now hops up on the doghouse and starts talking further to Woodstock, saying, "A big truck came along, and instead of flying, they ran like mad. They didn't take off into the air until the last minute." "Why do they do that?" asks Snoopy. "Why don't they fly? They're birds. Why do they run? I don't understand." And then Woodstock gives a huge explanation in chirps, to which Snoopy says, "I see." He doesn't know.
That's also Jimmy Gownley.
This seems to me, again, the very middle-aged Snoopy, because you sit around going like, these kids today, these birds today, why do they do this stupid thing? When I was a kid, the quails would fly, but now they're not even bothered.
Why do birds suddenly appear every time you are near?
That one just made me laugh out loud. Oh, okay. But now we're coming to March 27th. I'm telling you now, this is my strip of the year. No one's calling it. This is mine. Charlie Brown is at the thinking wall, and he looks absolutely depressed. Lucy comes up holding a piece of paper, and she says, "I figured it out, Charlie Brown. If you stay depressed for 2 more days, you'll make it into the Book of World Records." Charlie Brown hears this, lights up, and says, "Wow, that's great." Big smile on his face. To which panel 4, Lucy throws the paper over her shoulder and says, "You just blew it."
Can't even get depressed right.
That is a real condensation of the Charlie Brown character in 4 panels. I love that. March 31st. Oh, so it's 1980. So, of course, it's census time. And Snoopy has become a census taker. In panel 1, he says, "Here's the world famous census taker making his rounds." And he's wearing a fedora while he's carrying his clipboard and papers. He rings the bell. Someone answers the door and says yes, and then he counts them by putting a paw print right on this rando's forehead and says 1.
That's why I picked this. Actually, I went, is this somebody we know? I mean, it looks a hell of a lot like Charlie Brown except for the hair.
And maybe Charlie Brown's trying something. He's like trying to pee.
That's Charlie Brown's bedhead.
Yeah, right.
Woke him up.
I love the hat. Snoopy in a fedora. That's good stuff. April 6th. Pepper and Patty and Marcy are hanging out at the Caddy Shack. And then we see in panel 2, because they're caddying at a golf club. In panel 2, we see a shrub talking that says, "I was always sure that I'd be tall. Actually, I had always hoped that it'd be a giant redwood, but this is just, in fact, a shrub." So in the next panel, we see Peppermint Patty and Marcy doing their caddying and saying, "A good caddy, Marcy, should know every inch of the course." Marcy says, "I can appreciate that, sir." Peppermint Patty says, "We should know every tree and bunker on the course." Marcy says, "What about that little tree over there, sir?" And as they say this, they're carrying these large golf bags full of clubs up the hill. In the next panel, Peppermint Patty says, they have those on each fairway, Marcy. They tell the golfer that he's 150 yards from the green. In the next panel, as they walk by the little shrub, the shrub says, I refuse to accept that. My mother didn't raise me to be a 150-yard marker.
See, I draw the line here. I totally accept the school building thinking.
Sure.
Okay. I will not accept the shrub thinking. I'm sorry.
And then why is that?
The shrub is talking. It's not thinking. Beagles think, shrubs talk, and Schultz's
yeah. Word, right? Now, this is like, no.
Everything is sentient.
This is absurd. Yeah, there's, well, I think the building has more of a history. The building's been around, but the shrub, no.
I do you know what I think your tolerance for absurdity is in direct relation to your blood sugar.
Sure, I'm starving.
As we get closer to Michael's dinner time, this is ridiculous. Yeah, I don't know, but I can't really defend the talking shrub either.
I mean, is every tree, all those little flowers in panel five, are they all thinking things?
They sure are.
What about the soda cans next to Marcy?
Where do we draw the line here?
Well, you know, there are many philosophies in which people believe that everything has sentience and has a soul. So maybe
the golf clubs?
Golf clubs too, especially golf clubs. Anyway, what I really want to say is May 7th.
Hey, wait a second here. But say Schultz is present because he's got Caddyshack. Wall there, which it's like 3 months before the movie comes out. Maybe he had to subscribe to Variety magazine and knew it was coming. I'm done.
May 7th. Snoopy's playing tennis. this is a series of strips where Snoopy is going to join some tennis tournaments, and Charlie Brown's questioning about it. He says to Snoopy, a women's tournament? You can't enter a women's tournament. You think you can pretend you're Billie Jean King or someone? And in the last panel, we see Snoopy, who has tied his ears up into pigtails, and he says, Tracy Austin.
I drew a blank on that one.
Oh, Tracy Austin was a young phenom. She was like a teenager when she hit it big. I don't believe, though, that her career panned out over the long term as well as people thought it was going to.
And it seemed like tennis really was, this was like the peak of tennis in American culture, right? It was
John McEnroe was also referenced in this.
And then Jimmy Connors and Bjorn Borg. It just seemed like more people were following tennis than any other time in this era.
And if you want to read David Foster Wallace like Michael is, you can check out Tracy Austin Broke My Heart, an essay he wrote about her memoir, which is great.
Yeah, and I don't know how he does it, but Snoopy does look like Tracy Austin in that last panel.
It's amazing. He looks like John McEnroe in the one before. He's a brilliant cartoonist. May 12th. Oh, we have the entire bird scout troop is here, and Snoopy is kind of call and roll. He says, all right, men, answer as I call your name. Woodstock, Bill, Conrad, Olivier. And then we hear another chirp. And Snoopy says, Harriet? Who's Harriet? And Snoopy says in the third panel, and why, pray tell, should Harriet be invited to join our group? To which I guess Woodstock or one of the birds says something. And then Snoopy, with a big smile on his face, says, right, anyone who brings along an angel food cake with 7-minute frosting is welcome.
Now, I didn't understand this at all.
What don't you understand?
That's because your mother was a horrible
My mother never baked a cake in her life.
Oh, really?
Really?
No. Was that a health thing or just
she was not
a baker?
Competent.
Yeah, she was not going to bother.
So that makes it unrelatable.
Sounded like we didn't have cake, but they have nice cakes at the store. I mean, come on.
They do have nice cake. You can't go wrong with an Edmonds now and again.
Yeah, although you don't know how many minutes it took to make the frosting.
That's right. Angel food cake with 7-minute frosting. I've never had angel food cake with frosting of any kind.
True.
I've had angel food cake with whipped cream and strawberries, but
yes.
Yeah.
That's the way to do it.
Something that's a thing right now in the United States seems to be bundt cakes.
That's, I love a good bundt
made a
cake.
Comeback.
Yeah. Yes. I didn't know that. That's great.
Nothing bundt cakes chain is.
Yeah, well, expanded. The Nazis are coming back too, so
Bun Cakes and Nazis. Well, that's not going to be the title of this episode, but we've reached the end of this one. I'm really excited to get back to it because we still have our picks of the year and our MVP and the anger and happiness index and all of that to get to, but that'll have to wait till next time. So between now and then, what I want you to do is go onto our website and sign up for the Great Peanuts Reread so you can get that fantastic once a month newsletter that'll let you know what we're studying. I would love to hear from you at any and all of our social medias, or you can call us on our hotline, which is
717-219-4162.
Yeah, so you give us a call and we'll check in next time and we'll get through the second half of 1980. Lots of good stuff coming up. Until then, for Michael, Harold, and Liz, I've been Jimmy. Be of good cheer.
Yes.
Be of good cheer.
Be of good cheer.
Unpacking Peanuts is copyright Jimmy Gownley, Michael Cohen, and Harold Buchholz. Produced and edited by Liz Sumner. Music by Michael Cohen. Additional voiceover by Aziza Shukrala Clark. For more from the show, follow Unpack Peanuts on Instagram and Threads, Unpacking Peanuts on Facebook, Blue Sky, and YouTube. For more about Jimmy, Michael, and Harold, visit unpackingpeanuts.com. Have a wonderful day, and thanks for listening.
I'm done.